Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today, we are going to be speaking with Dr. Liz Goldstein. She is a staff psychologist at the Veterans Administration, and we're going to be talking about PTSD and veterans. So, Dr. Goldstein, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me today.
Excited to have you, and I appreciate the work that you do. So let's learn more about the work you do. And let me start off with asking you, when it comes to veterans and sleep medicine or behavioral sleep medicine, what types of things do veterans experience as relates to sleep?
That's a great question. And we see a wide variety of presenting concerns. But I can give you a little more detail based in sleep science and what we've seen in research, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what I see in my own clinic. So on the research side, in 2020, Fulmer et al. Published a paper in Sleep Medicine Reviews using VA medical record data to characterize sleep disorder diagnoses seen in veterans receiving care in Veterans Health Administration facilities. So basically VA hospitals, national data set, electronic health record data. So it's a pretty big sample. And sleep-related breathing disorders like sleep apnea and insomnia were the two most prevalent sleep disorders seen. And I know we're talking about PTSD today, so there's another paper that I'd like to highlight. And it's a little older. It's from 2016. But Alexander et al. Also used VA medical record data, and specifically looking at veterans with PTSD, again, sleep-related breathing disorders and insomnia were the most commonly seen disorders, and they were more prevalent among veterans with PTSD compared to those without PTSD. So that's the research side. In clinic, that's absolutely what we see. The most common complaints I see are insomnia and sleep apnea, specifically difficulty tolerating treatments for sleep apnea. We also see nightmares. We might see some dream reenactment, but probably 90% of the consults I receive in clinic are for insomnia and sleep apnea.
Wow. Okay. So can you clarify for us a little bit the difference between nightmares and dream reenactment? What would one look like compared to the other?
That's a really good question, and it's something that a bed partner is probably more likely to notice than the patient themselves. So nightmares are something we've probably all experienced here or there. They're bad dreams. They're dreams that we have where something scary or unpleasant happens. And we wake up while we're having this dream. We may have a brief recollection of what it's about, but even if we don't quite remember exactly what happened, we often have an emotional feeling, like fear or horror or sadness. And so it can be, it's basically a very negatively valenced bad dream. Again, they're really common in people with PTSD. They might be more common, but we all experience them here or there. Dream reenactment is when you are possibly shouting, speaking, or moving while you're having your dream. And it's not really supposed to happen by design. When we're sleeping and we're having REM sleep, that I know that's been talked about on this podcast before, but when we're having REM sleep, our bodies usually paralyze us. They relax our muscles so we don't act out our dreams, which is a very adaptive thing. But sometimes when people have dreams, they might act them out. So if somebody's having a nightmare about their combat experience, they might be shouting, they might even like rush and fall off the bed or even leave their bedroom. And sometimes it happens in the context of having a trauma-associated sleep disorder related to PTSD, but can also happen outside the context of trauma too. So basically, nightmares are very common, but dream reenactment is when you're actually physically or vocally adding a component to it in real life.
Wow, wow. And I guess you're in, and if that's happening while you're asleep, you wouldn't know, which is why you said it's typically the bed partner that knows.
Yeah, my patients will often tell me they wake up on the floor, they wake up sweaty, their bed partner's scared or possibly angry with them, and they don't know what happened. They're not aware of what's happening. So we have to have conversations about safety and sometimes about whether it makes sense to perhaps have the bed partner sleep somewhere else while we get them treatment. So right. It can be a really scary experience to not remember what you're doing in your sleep if it's anything other than just sleeping.
Right. Wow. And so with that, am I right in saying that if someone is just having a regular nightmare, then typically that's happened while their body is more kind of out of commission, that they're not moving their muscles or doing anything, they're just dreaming it or thinking it.
Exactly, yeah. It's just what's happening in their minds. And there's research showing that when we're dreaming and in REM sleep, our brains are basically as active as they are when we're awake. So it's a really active time in our minds. It's not really supposed to be an active time in our bodies.
Got it. Okay. So, you know, sleep apnea, insomnia, the things that you talked about tend to be sort of the main things that anybody, veteran or not, you know, tends to talk about if they have a sleep issue. Are there any things in particular that you're aware of related to veterans that are different in terms of number, intensity, presentation, et cetera, than we would see in a non-veteran community?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And there's not a lot of research that's currently published directly comparing veterans to non-veterans. I actually have some work that will be coming out soon, but it hasn't come out just yet. Mm-hmm. But I can speak to some surprising things I've seen in terms of the prevalence or the presentation in veterans. So first, in terms of sleep apnea, because this is a very common condition that we see in veterans and non-veterans, one of the most surprising things I've read is that about 70% of veterans with PTSD screen positive for sleep apnea. So it's overwhelming. And this doesn't even just extend to screening only. When polysomnography is done, so when these patients go into a sleep lab and have the gold standard testing for sleep apnea, 70% of military veterans with PTSD have diagnosed sleep apnea. So it's an overwhelming majority, and it's absolutely shocking. So when I am teaching trainees in our PTSD clinics about what to look for in terms of sleep disorders, I tell them to assume a patient has sleep apnea until proven otherwise, because it's more common than a coin flip. It's an absolutely overwhelming majority. We're not exactly sure why. Mm-hmm. We can't say that there's anything causative in either direction, but a lot of veterans with PTSD have sleep apnea, and we also see a high risk of sleep apnea in civilians with PTSD too. So it's not limited to veterans, but because so many veterans do have PTSD, it's something important to know about this population. So sleep apnea is super common. Insomnia is incredibly common in people with PTSD as well. About 90% of people with PTSD have difficulty falling or staying asleep. So practically everybody with PTSD has some kind of sleep difficulty, whether it's sleep apnea, insomnia, or perhaps nightmares. It's a really hallmark aspect of the disorder.
It's interesting because I wouldn't just naturally equate one with the other, but maybe I should ask this question. You know, when I hear the letters PTSD, I think back to like movies that I might see in the theater, right? Or TV shows or something. And in those shows or movies, I picture someone having these like horrible flashbacks and things that put them in another state. Can you define for us and give us an example of what really is PTSD and what does it really look like for someone who may have it?
Yeah, sure. I'd be really happy to do that. I've got like a book right here where I could totally just talk about that. But I'm glad you brought that up because the PTSD that we see depicted in the media looks very different than the PTSD that I see with my patients in a clinic room. Mm-hmm. So the first aspect of having PTSD is being exposed to a trauma, some kind of traumatic event. It could be something like combat, but there's a lot of traumatic events that meet criteria for PTSD that have nothing to do with military service. So, for example, experiencing a natural disaster, it wouldn't be unreasonable that some of the folks experiencing the LA fires, for example, might experience PTSD down the line. Mm-hmm. Car accidents could result in PTSD. Unexpectedly and violently losing a loved one, interpersonal violence. There's all sorts of different traumatic events that could result in PTSD. And not everybody who experiences a traumatic event is going to develop PTSD. Mm-hmm. It's really common for people to have some of the symptoms I'm about to describe in the days or weeks following a traumatic event. But for many or even most people, the symptoms dwindle down over the course of the first 3 months. But when the symptoms continue for a few months, that's when we start to think like, oh, this might be a PTSD diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So we've got the traumatic event, and then we've got all sorts of different symptoms that can happen in different combinations. Okay. So, for example, flashbacks, for example. That's something I think people think about a lot when they see things depicted in the media. Like somebody suddenly thinks they're back in Vietnam, they hear a loud noise, and they take cover. Flashbacks can be feeling like you're back in the event, but they're often not as dramatic as we see. Other types of symptoms of re-experiencing like flashbacks might be things like intrusive nightmares, like we talked about a little bit already. So that might be a type of re-experiencing, or suddenly, if you're reminded of the traumatic event, suddenly physically feeling like you're there, like maybe your heart starts pounding, you begin sweating, but it might not be as dramatic as a flashback. Mm-hmm. So people experience re-experiencing. Oftentimes, people with PTSD will have symptoms of avoidance, which makes a lot of sense. Why would you want to intentionally engage with something horrible that happened in your life? So they may avoid external reminders of the trauma, like if they experience the traumatic event in a particular locality, they might avoid restaurants from that cuisine, or they might avoid going to a crowded big box store on Sunday mornings. Or they might avoid the mall. So avoiding situations that remind them of the trauma or make them feel similarly unsafe.
Right.
They also might avoid internal reminders. Like if something pops up and it was their buddy's birthday and their buddy had passed away, they might intentionally stay really busy that day to not think about their friend that they lost. Mm-hmm. So we see avoidance. Another type of symptom that we see is hyperarousal or hypervigilance. And this is where a lot of the sleep disorders come into play, because insomnia, difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, is a type of hyperarousal or hypervigilance. So we might see sleep difficulty. You might see somebody feeling on alert or on watch for bad things. A lot of the folks I work with always need to know where the exit is in any particular situations.
Wow.
So if they come in person for appointment, I actually intentionally show them like the fastest way out of the building.
Right.
Because a lot of them find that to be helpful information. And then a final type of symptom that we often see in PTSD are changes in thoughts or mood. So oftentimes people will blame themselves for what happened. They might experience some guilt or shame. So that could be a prominent part of the disorder. They could also feel depressed or down. They might actually also not experience any emotions and feel kind of emotionally numb. So we've got all these kinds of symptoms, and technically to meet criteria, you need one from this category and two from this category, and mental health providers can check off boxes and figure it out. But one of the things that I think is so cool about PTSD is that it could present completely differently in several people. You could have somebody who really presents sleep heavy, and they have nightmare difficulty, and they have insomnia difficulty, and like that's their particular presentation, and they feel really depressed, and it's hard for them to get out of bed in the morning. But you could also have somebody present entirely differently, and they actually appear very functional, but a lot of their symptoms are internal, and we don't see that dysfunction as easily.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So I have a follow-up question there. I'm going to ask you the question, but then I'm going to jump to a commercial break, and we'll come back and answer it. My question is, when you were talking about the various symptoms, one of the things you were talking about was sort of avoidance. And I was thinking to myself, are the people intentionally, actively avoiding these things knowingly, or are they just avoiding them and not even knowing why they're avoiding them? But don't answer yet. We got to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back with Dr. Liz Goldstein, and we'll get the answer to that question.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're speaking with Dr. Liz Goldstein, and we're talking about PTSD and sleep. Before the break, I posed a question about people avoiding things who have PTSD. Dr. Goldstein, do they do it intentionally, or do they just realize that they're doing it and not even know why?
That's a very good question, and I think it's different for everybody. There are definitely some patients who say they will never go to a crowded place. It's too unsafe. There are too many threats. And they're acutely aware of it. Or they have really complicated routines that they've figured out. Like they go to the grocery store at 10:30 p.m. on a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And they know exactly where to go in the store and in what order so that they're very unlikely to run into anybody, and so they can keep an eye on the exits and really elaborate plans. So for some people, it's definitely intentional. For other people, it's quite unintentional, and they may not realize they're doing it until they've landed in a treatment provider's room and we start asking questions. Mm-hmm. And I may ask them, like, do you avoid things? And they say no. And I say, okay, hey, when's the last time you saw your family? Oh, 20 years ago. When was the trauma? 20 years ago. And so sometimes it's a provider might have to think about the situation and different ways avoidance can manifest. I will say that one way that avoidance can manifest that a lot of patients don't realize is in engagement with a healthcare system or with healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. A lot of patients with PTSD are hesitant to ask for help. Mm-hmm. And I conceptualize this as an avoidance process. It is a scary thing to be vulnerable and talk about a problem you're having and to ask for help with it. And by avoiding the problem altogether or accepting it as part of your everyday life, I think that's a form of unintentional avoidance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, okay. So, you know, let's talk about stigma for a minute, because a lot of people who have any sort of issue, whether it be a mental health or a physical health disorder, sometimes feel a stigma about it. And I can only imagine that in the military, you know, probably there's a culture of, you know, tough and strong and things like that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm guessing. And is there any stigma for people when they have any sort of a sleep disorder or a PTSD symptom to seek help?
I think there is stigma, and particularly for PTSD, maybe not quite so much for a sleep disorder. Mm-hmm. In terms of PTSD, there is research showing that patients who, specifically veteran patients, who screen positive for mental health concerns endorse concerns about stigma at a higher rate than people who don't endorse a mental health problem, which is really problematic because the patients who screen positive for these mental health concerns are the one who need care, but they're also the most concerned about stigma, which I think also probably makes sense. Mm-hmm. A lot of patients don't want to be lumped together with the depictions of PTSD in the media, or they're concerned that other people will think they're violent or they're scary. And also because of the symptoms that people with PTSD often have that I was describing earlier, they might feel some self-blame or guilt about what happened. And so talking about what happened and getting care for their PTSD symptoms can feel really stigmatizing and blamey. It doesn't feel very good. And that's one of the reasons I really like practicing in behavioral sleep medicine or sleep psychology in VA. Mm-hmm. I see sleep's role as kind of the side door to mental health. So rather than patients walking through the front door to the mental health clinic and having a full mental health intake and talking about all of their mental health difficulties, I offer a clinical setting that is relatively low stigma, that is embedded in a very medical clinic focused solely on sleep disorders. And it's kind of low-hanging fruit to talk about your difficulty falling asleep or the interruptions you have to your sleep because of your sleep apnea, rather than talking about all of your PTSD symptoms. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a much lower level of stigma about sleep disorders, and it can be a nice way to introduce people to what behavioral health care can look like. And hopefully they have a good experience with sleep psychology, and they start to get more comfortable with what it's like to talk about your feelings or talk about your behaviors or your thoughts and become more willing to get treatment for PTSD afterwards.
So, you know, you raise a good point there that I haven't thought about before. And I guess the question then is, so it sounds like people would come to you, and they're coming to you originally because they're having some sort of a sleep issue. And as a result of the work that you start doing with them, then you discover that there's PTSD. Is that kind of how it works?
That's often the way it works. Many of my patients are being seen in sleep medicine. Their primary care doctor thought they might have sleep apnea, and they go get tested, and it turns out they do, and they see my colleagues, and they get treatment. And then when treatment's not going so great, maybe it's not treating, maybe they can't tolerate the treatment they were given, or their sleep apnea is treated, but it's become apparent they have insomnia. And so they're sent to me. And so I'll see the patient for their presenting complaint, whatever it may be. But I'm doing some assessment and I'm asking them some questions to get a sense of, like, could they have PTSD? I know it's a high base rate in this population. Mm-hmm. I may be the first provider who they ever tell about the traumatic event they experienced. In fact, I often am. Patients are very avoidant about talking about really hard things in their life. And why wouldn't they be? Nobody wants to talk about this stuff.
Right.
Especially with a provider they just met with for, 5 minutes?
Right.
So I'm often the first provider they've got a whole hour with. And I'm asking them, like, hey, have you experienced this in your life? Have you ever experienced an event where your safety felt threatened or you could have died? And as we're working together, they might feel comfortable sharing what happened. So it's very common that patients come in thinking we're going to talk just about their sleep problems, and then might discover that they have PTSD or a related trauma-related disorder.
So technically then, let's say someone comes in, you start working on a sleep problem, you discover that there may or probably is PTSD as part of the patient's issues. Is that something that you then can treat in your sleep clinic, or do you have to refer them to someone else? Like, can you treat them both together? Or do they need separate treatments?
That's a really excellent question as well. And that's, logistically, there's one answer, and then clinically, there's another answer.
Okay.
So clinically, people usually need treatment for, if they've got both and they want their symptoms of both to remit, they're probably going to need treatment for both the PTSD and the sleep problem.
Okay.
Research demonstrates that when people are treated using our gold standard treatments for PTSD, their sleep symptoms often don't get better, unfortunately. They might get a little better, but usually people still need sleep treatment afterwards. On the flip side, some of our treatments for sleep disorders treat the sleep symptoms, and we often do see improvements above and beyond that in terms of PTSD symptoms. And that's part of what got me into this work. I really liked that we could treat PTSD through treating sleep and not really even touch the traumatic event directly too much. But even still, there are going to be some symptoms that we just don't address through sleep treatment. So a lot of patients need both. So that's a pretty hot topic right now in the research world, trying to figure out how to best combine treatments, how to best sequence treatments.
Mm-hmm.
I know in clinic I like doing the sleep work first because it's lower stigma, and because we often do get movement on the PTSD symptoms, it gives people hope. It gives them the opportunity to see, like, wow, I can get better for some of these symptoms. Like, maybe it's worth trying something else too. So personally, that's what I like to do, but research will bear out, like, how to best combine treatments. Logistically, right, is a different issue. A lot of providers who provide behavioral sleep care, like I do, have backgrounds in health psychology, and they're used to treating medical concerns generally, and that's their background. I come from a different background. I actually have a lot of experience treating mood disorders and PTSD, and I came into sleep through that direction. So I'm really well situated to treat PTSD after I treat the sleep disorder, and sometimes I have that opportunity in my clinic just to provide continuity of care. Like, I've worked with somebody for 2 months, and they say, I'm ready to do PTSD treatment, but I'd really rather do it with you. Like, I can often make that work. But that's just a perk of my care setting, and it's not always possible. If I'm booked up, it's probably not going to happen. So it really depends on the provider and the setting. And we're still figuring a lot about how to optimize. One thing I will say is it can be really tricky to treat them both at the same time. Treatments for sleep disorders are hard. They're a lot of work, especially behavioral treatments. It asks people to change a lot of behaviors, and treatment for PTSD, especially behavioral treatments, are hard too.
Wow. So, okay, I want to get into treatments and all in just a little bit, but before we dive deep into those, I do have one question from something that you were talking about earlier that has been kind of in the back of my brain here, and it's this. When you were saying that a lot of people with PTSD seem to also have sleep apnea as one issue. You know, when I think of sleep apnea, and I think in general when people think of sleep apnea, they think of a stereotypical, typically a middle-aged male, a little bit overweight, so on and so forth. And that's where we're looking at obstructive sleep apnea, different from central sleep apnea. So my question for you is, when you're talking about sleep apnea with veterans, are you talking about obstructive or central? And if you're talking about obstructive, I picture most veterans to be, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, but in better shape and all. And are there any theories as to why there's this connection between PTSD and apnea?
That is a lot. All right, let's see what we can cover. So thinking about people who might not be as familiar, obstructive sleep apnea is when you're asleep and your airway becomes obstructed or blocked. And it can become blocked in a few different ways. There's a few different things that can lead to that, but it can do with muscle tone. It could do with the size of your airway. It could do with your weight. And if you happen to carry some weight at the base of your tongue, it's going to block your airway. And so that's obstructive sleep apnea. And that's the most common type of sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got central sleep apnea, where it's more like your brain forgot to breathe. You're not really making the effort to breathe. So we've got these two different kinds of sleep apnea, and sometimes, oftentimes, people could have a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
I'm generally talking about obstructive sleep apnea, which I think is a strange consideration. Like, I think a lot of people would expect to see that PTSD has to do with central sleep apnea because they're both disorders of the brain.
Right.
But like a lot of things in health, it's not as simple as this is brain and this is body. But in general, like if we combine it, most of what we're seeing is obstructive sleep apnea, but it could be both.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that PTSD and sleep apnea have in common. If you think about it, they both have a lot to do with hyperarousal. In PTSD, you are concerned for your safety. You're looking for threats. It's hard to sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're so alert and vigilant to threats. When you have sleep apnea, you're not getting enough oxygen at night. You're hypoxemic.
Right.
If it's obstructive, your airway's closing off. If it's central, you're not making the effort to breathe, but either way, your oxygen is dropping.
Mm-hmm.
Your body knows this. You're not dying from that. What it's doing is it's going to have you have a micro arousal. It's going to have you awaken. You might not perceive all these awakenings during the night, but it's on your body and your mind are on high alert, and they're saying, "Andrew, wake up and breathe for me." And so it's a kind of similar process. Your brain and your body can't get rest at night because either you're looking for threat or you have a very real threat of not having enough oxygen.
Right.
So they're very similar processes. So in some regards, I'm not surprised that they co-occur so much. There's a lot of speculation as to what could possibly be causing this. Kathy McCall has a great paper about it. Ali Al-Sol and colleagues have a great paper about it. They do some really nice jobs laying out different hypotheses and pathways for it.
Mm-hmm.
It could have something to do with muscle tone, related to both. It could have, I think inflammation is a possibility, or things to do with the HPA axis in the brain and alertness and sympathetic tone. But the reality is all of these ideas are speculative, and there's a lot of research going on, and nobody is quite sure what's happening. And this is why it's a fun place to be a sleep scientist right now, because there's a lot we don't know, and it's a very real problem.
Right. Right. And sleep science tends to be a very active area right now. So a lot of new things are being looked into that we don't have answers to. So let me do a quick break here again, and then we'll come back and let's talk treatment. So we'll be right back on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
All right, we're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Dr. Liz Goldstein. Let's talk about treatment. So somebody comes into your office and you find out that they actually have PTSD and they are tested and turns out they have obstructive sleep apnea. And let's throw in, they also end up having insomnia on top of all that. So they've got everything going on. What types of things are available in terms of treatment? What can they expect? What do you do? What do they look like? Give us the whole background here.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it sounds like a really niche thing to have PTSD and sleep apnea and insomnia, but it's really not. This trifecta is very, very common in terms of what I see in clinic, and it's my research interest as well. So it's something that comes up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So conveniently, the VA and Department of Defense produce clinical practice guidelines for different types of conditions and disorders. And the VA DoD clinical practice guidelines for insomnia and sleep apnea actually do a really excellent job of characterizing which treatment options have the most evidence for efficacy for each of these disorders. It lays out like considerations around screening and testing and treatment. So according to these guidelines, which are based on the most recent research, the gold standard treatment for sleep apnea is positive airway pressure or PAP therapy, or some people call it CPAP. Although there are other effective treatments available and are definitely available to veterans. So on the sleep apnea side, PAP is often our gold standard treatment, but there are other things we consider.
Okay.
And the PTSD diagnosis might have something to do with that. On the insomnia side, the gold standard treatment for insomnia is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, also known as CBTI.
Okay.
So we tend to recommend these for everybody, regardless of whether they have PTSD or not. And behavioral sleep providers play a really important role in facilitating adherence and access to both of these treatments.
Okay, so are these things that you're going to be treating simultaneously, or do you do one first?
That's another area that's pretty hot in the literature right now and is something that even I'm looking at. There are pros and cons to treating these in certain orders. And a lot of it realistically happens due to which is diagnosed first and what are they getting care for. So a lot of our veterans get care for sleep apnea, and that's their initial pathway into sleep care. So that might be what they get treated for first. But either they have residual symptoms after their sleep apnea is treated, or they might find that they have trouble tolerating treatment for sleep apnea, because wearing a CPAP mask can be quite triggering if somebody has PTSD, especially if the trauma involved claustrophobia or something on their face.
Mm-hmm.
And so, interestingly, there's another factor that can play into it, too, which is that people with insomnia have more difficulty tolerating treatment for sleep apnea. If you're already having trouble falling asleep, and then we put a mask on your face, it's going to make it harder for you to sleep at night. And so for those patients, treating the insomnia first might be more important. And so we have to think about the presentation. The most pressing concern is the patient complaining most that they have difficulty falling asleep at the beginning of the night. Is that their number one? If so, let's treat their insomnia. If their biggest complaint is that they're having middle of the night awakenings and a lot of them, let's treat their sleep apnea. So it's going to be different for everybody, but it often does just come down to which disorder was identified first.
Right. So you mentioned that there are different types of treatments, even with sleep apnea. Okay, CPAP, I think a lot of people have heard about that. And I think that, you know, I know in literature that I've read, there's a tremendous number of people who feel that they can't tolerate having the CPAP on their face. So what other options are available if someone has that type of an issue?
Yeah, that's an important consideration, because it's true. A lot of patients struggle with PAP masks or PAP in general. Like one military study found that about 60% of people without PTSD met criteria for adherent use. Mm-hmm. People with PTSD, it was only 25%. So this is a problem across the board, but especially a problem in people with PTSD. I will be honest that I have a preference to work with people with PTSD on their PAP adherence, because one of the coolest things about PAP for sleep apnea is that it not only treats the symptoms of sleep apnea, like daytime sleepiness and fatigue, but research also shows that it helps the PTSD, especially nightmares. And I think that's a really compelling reason to try to use your PAP. So I always start there.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's not going to happen, it's important that the apnea still get treated. And just because we don't have the evidence for the PTSD remitting with these other treatments doesn't mean that's not the case. It's just the research hasn't been done. So other treatments that are available include oral appliances. So in the VA, we can have our dental services actually fabricate customized devices. We're not sending people to their pharmacy to get like a boil and kind of thing. We're right. Actually making people really sophisticated devices. Mm-hmm. And what the oral appliance does is it moves your jaw forward a little bit so that your airway expands. You have more space there. You're not as likely to experience an obstruction. So oral appliances are a great option, especially if somebody has more mild to moderate sleep apnea. There's new devices coming out every day. I will admit that we tend to have a very high standard for the evidence that needs to be available before we'll start handing things out, because we want to have a high confidence that the treatments will work. Mm-hmm. So we are skeptical about some of the things that come out, but oral appliances are something we refer for a lot. There also are surgical approaches to sleep apnea that can really offer a nice solution for folks who don't want to be concerned with cleaning and being prepared for their sleep, and especially if they travel. So there's different types of surgical approaches that are good options as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, so let's do this. Just in the interest of time, I'd love to at least hear a quick version from you in terms of your thoughts about what the future might hold. What types of things are being studied, or what type of opportunities might be coming out there? Anything you can share with us? You know, we've got about a minute or so left. That would be great.
Sure. Yeah. So I can, since we have a minute left, I could highlight three VA-funded trials that are either completed or underway that are looking at behavioral approaches for sleep disorders, because a lot of our veterans aren't interested in medication-based approaches. Mm-hmm. So Peter Colvinin just wrapped up a trial looking at an integrative CBTI mm-hmm. and for insomnia and prolonged exposure for PTSD. Shiram, again, has an ongoing trial at the San Francisco VA looking at a brief behavioral treatment for insomnia in veterans with PTSD. And I'm actually just wrapping up a clinical trial looking at a behavioral intervention to promote CPAP adherence and treat insomnia in veterans with PTSD. So there's several ongoing trials specifically looking at behavioral approaches I'm very excited about.
Wow, that's wonderful. Yeah, I didn't know this, so I bet the audience doesn't know this. When it comes to sleep medicine and behavioral sleep medicine especially, the Veterans Administration has been a leader in a lot of this work and has sort of set the standards because of all the research that they do and all the great people like yourself that have the focus on this area. So, you know, VA is not following here. I would, in my opinion, they're leaders here. And that's wonderful to hear because, you know, all of the research helps everybody, not just the veterans. So
yeah, we absolutely feel grateful that we can conduct this research, and a lot of the resources and treatment guides and evidence are all available publicly so that everybody can benefit from the findings we conduct in VA.
Yeah. Great. Well, we are out of time for today's episode. So Dr. Liz Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us, sharing the information about PTSD and how it impacts sleep. We appreciate all the work that you do. And as you're continuing to do new studies and learning new things, maybe you'll be able to come on again in the future and share some new things that you've learned.
Great. That would be fun. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.